Track session number 12507, Reel 7.
Field Marshal Lord Bramall, Reel 7. Field Marshal, in your entry in Who's Who, it says that between 1953 and 1958, you were in the Middle East. What were you actually doing when you were there?
Well, this covers quite a long period and a number of jobs, but after the Staff College, and I was at the Staff College in 1952, and my posting after the Staff College was to be G2, as it was called in those days, GSO2, and now it would be SO2, G3 or something like that, but I was the G2 operations of 3rd Division, which had just gone to the Middle East. It had gone from England to Cyprus, and then from Cyprus it went to the Canal Zone, where we were having a confrontation with the Egyptian government, which had Farouk had just been overthrown. General Naguib had taken over with Nasser as his right-hand man. And then, of course, Nasser pushed Naguib out and took over. And there was a confrontation against the Canal Zone of Egypt, and we had a large number of troops there, the 3rd Division in the north, the 1st Division in the south, and we were, to some extent, beleaguered. We were keeping the canal open, but we were in our various fairly fortified camps, and there were a number of acts of sabotage and things happening, ambushes and sabotage throughout the canal zone and round the big British depot at Tel Kebir. And there were a number of battles. Just before I arrived there, the British had assaulted the police station at Ismailia because the police were hostile and sort of carrying out slightly warlike acts against the British forces, and the whole of this was, of course, was the Egyptians trying to get the British to get out of the canal zone and to revoke the treaty under which they had troops in that area. So I was G2 operations for 2 years in 53 and 54, and it was very interesting because we had internal security problems. We also did a great deal of training in both the western desert and in the eastern desert in Sinai. And we also had some contingency plans to go to the delta if the position in the canal zone got too difficult to handle, which was a sort of forerunner, I suppose, of the Suez operation. And so that was very interesting. My divisional commander with most of the time was General Nigel Poet, and then General Jack Churcher. And I suppose I had a key and important job. I had an excellent G1 above me, General John Willoughby. And they were very interesting days. So that was the first part. And then when I had finished my tour of duty, I came back for a short time to the United Kingdom to be the training company commander at our Green Jacket depot at Winchester. And that was actually in 55, 56, so I was out of the Middle East at that time. But in the middle of 56, just before the Suez operation, I went out to the Middle East again to command a company in the 1st Battalion, King's Royal Rifle Corps, which was in Libya. And I went out really when we were on the brink of the Suez operation. And when I went out there, the intention was for the 1st Armoured Division, which was strung the whole way along the Libyan border from Tobruk in the east to Tripoli in the west, would be one of the elements which came into Egypt if the British took action under I can't remember what the name of the code word now was, you may remember, but it was the initial Suez operation was designed to land at Alexandria and take over the delta. And it was only later that plan was switched from Alexandria to Port Said. So those. So I was a company commander there, and in between, I had quite an interesting job, which is worth telling you about, because when I was due to leave the depot to go and join the 1st Battalion, I was suddenly summoned to go to the War Office. And the reason I was summoned was that General Poet, who had been my divisional commander, had taken over as Director of Military Operations, and the Suez operation was being planned. MO4, who dealt with the Middle East, was thought to be greatly overworked. I had been in MO4, as you know, some years before, 47. I'd been his G2 in 3rd Division. He thought I was just the man to go in and supplement the MO4 staff to help plan the operation. Well, that by the time I got there, General Stockwell had set up his own headquarters in the basement of the War Office, and the detailed planning had been taken out of the hands of the military operations directorate. And I really only acted as a sort of liaison officer between MO4 and General Stockwell's headquarters. And I spent my time going to General Poet saying, look, I'm wasting my time here. I ought to be commanding a company in my regiment in Libya, which may soon get into a shooting war. I'm far better employed there than here. And eventually he let me go, and I went out and joined in about, it'd be about October, I suppose, in September or October of 1956. But when I was in the War Office, I got to know the inklings of the original Suez plan, which was to land at Alexandria in what I call a poor man's Normandy invasion. And it even seemed to me then that we were absolutely in cloud cuckoo land. We were talking about what happened at D plus 62 and what came across the beaches. And I think even then that I realised that unless we did what we had to do in a very short time, there was no way we were going to keep the country and international opinion with us. And the whole plan was cloud cuckoo land. Of course, later on, the plan was completely changed to a much quicker action at port side, linked in, of course, with the Israeli attack and all the double dealings that went on around that Suez time. But when the Suez operation actually broke, I was in with my company in Tobruk. In fact, I'm deep down in the desert, and I got a message from my commanding officer to return to Tobruk and go up to the Egyptian frontier and act in a sort of watching capacity to see what was happening the other side prior, possibly, to the 1st Armoured Division moving in from the west, which it never did because of the Libyan treaty. And I remember when we headed north and I hearing that the Israelis had attacked and that British forces were going to be, British and French forces were going to be landed, although I'd been in on the earlier plan, I wasn't at all certain on whose side we were coming in on. So confusing, so muddled was the sort of political aim and concept for the whole operation.
I'd like to ask you a bit more about some of these things. When you went to the 3rd Division in the canal zone, you say that the camps were semi-fortified. Against what level of threat were they?
Compared with the way the camps are fortified in Northern Ireland, ridiculously so. I mean, they were surrounded by barbed wire. They had armed sentries round them, and they no doubt had barriers at the gates, and people had stand-to positions. But it was a very, very much lower threat than anything we experience today, and much less sophisticated threat.
At that time, what sort of estimate of the strength and capacity of the Egyptian army did you have?
I think we had a very poor assessment. And I think in hindsight, we were probably right. Between the time between that time, which was 53-54, and the time that the Suez operation was being planned, which is 56, the assessment, of course, had gone up very considerably because the Egyptians were said to have obtained a great deal of Russian equipment and Russian instructors and Russian advisers. And on this basis, I think the Egyptian army was estimated to have a higher fighting capability than it did in fact have. But when we were there, and we had plans to motor to Cairo or Alexandria or wherever, I don't think we anticipated that the Egyptian army would put up much of resistance.
Do you ever remember seeing any assessment that there might actually be some sympathy for maintaining a British presence amongst the Egyptian population or elements of it?
Well, I mean, they're obviously amongst the traders and people like that, of which, of course, there were quite a large number who didn't mind who was running the show as long as they were actually doing business and trading. And I imagine they would have been sorry. But, of course, there was a great upsurge, and I'm talking about the Delta, great upsurge in nationalism under Nasser, a sense of national identity. And Nasser became a very popular figure, there's no doubt about that. And, of course, not so very long afterwards, the British, in fact, did withdraw from the Canal Zone. And the 3rd Division went home, and then, of course, came out again in the Suez operation.
If the 3rd Division had gone to the Delta, would it have attempted to occupy Alexandria and the other cities in that area on a permanent or semi-permanent basis?
Well, this is, of course, you're talking about when we were there or when you're talking about Suez?
When you were there at the time of 53-54,
yes.
When you were making your plans.
Well, I think this bit was extremely hazily thought through. I mean, I think this was the some of the fallacy in the British presence then. I mean, you've got to remember that the parameters, political parameters, strategic parameters do change. But we were at the tail end of, if you'd said to any general or chiefs of staff, what is the crucial thing about British strategy, they would have said imperial communications, and imperial communications meant holding the Canal Zone, which they didn't think the Egyptians were capable of running, which, of course, through which all our, in those days, there were no great jumbo jets, no things overflying. Most of the things went by sea, and therefore this was absolutely essential. And you were really asking people to completely revise their strategy. I mean, in hindsight, it is shown that, of course, these days it's not important whether you held that at all. You also realise that the Egyptians were capable of running the canal, just as capable, really, as we with our Anglo-French pilots and people were. And so it was really based on a false assumption. But it was considered so essential that you were prepared to do almost anything to maintain this, and it took a long time to readjust your views. But, of course, this was the fallacy. If you went in, I think Templar said we could probably take Alexandria or Cairo with a brigade, but what the hell do we do then? I mean, how did you occupy it for an unlimited period? He said you probably needed several divisions to do it once you were there. And I don't think we'd thought as far as that. I think there was a general feeling that the British only got a roar and move into places, and that whatever government was in power would collapse, and we would put in somebody who would do what they were told. I think that was the feeling in those days. And, of course, subsequent events and nationalism in the Middle East and everything has shown how out of date that thinking was. Suez brought it to a head, and we all know the consequences.
You mentioned that you had two divisional commanders there, General Poet and then General Churcher. Now, one of them was a parachutist, wasn't he? Nigel Pert was.
Nigel Pert commanded the one of the parachute brigades in the invasion.
In Normandy, yes.
Normandy and over the Rhine crossing.
And would the General Churchill be the same one who was in the 11th Armoured Division?
Yes, he was the commander of the Lorient Infantry Brigade of 11th Armoured Division. Yeah. And he commanded more divisions for a longer time than anybody else, because he commanded a division in Palestine. He commanded that division in the Canal Zone and then took it back to England. And I think he commanded a division for a very, very long time. He was an experienced... straight up and down, but experienced infantry soldier.
Did you notice any change of style in the way in which the division was commanded and the headquarters was run when it changed from General Pert to General Churchill?
Well, yes. I think that General Pert was an extremely nice man. And in a way, and a very brave man. Very brave, very nice, very, very garrulous man. I thought a slightly, at that level, slightly muddled commander. But he was very good on paper, and he used to have lots of, shall we say, misunderstandings with his brigade commanders by not making his points crystal clear and them choosing to interpret them in a slightly different way. And as G2, I used to sometimes have to get into the middle of this and try and sort the thing out. Churchill was a very much blunter man, fairly irascible. Blunt, but very clear-headed chap, I think. And he was a pretty good divisional commander, I think, although not as congenial as Nigel Pert.
What sort of size was the divisional headquarters at that time? Did it conform to the same sort of pattern of organisation as divisional headquarters had in the Second World War?
Yes, I would say very much to what it had in the Second World War. I suspect it's grown a bit since then with various bits and pieces of specialists. But we were a very large division. We had a brigade, an infantry brigade in Tel el-Kebir. We had a guards brigade. I think it was 51 infantry brigade, commanded by the Earl of Caithness. We had a guards brigade at El Bala, with a battalion in Port Said. We had the parachute brigade, commanded by Brigadier Gordon, as he was then, and we had the commando brigade, commanded by Brigadier Moulton. So we had four very good brigades under operational command. Two of those were an integral part of the division, that's the infantry brigade and the guards brigade. With the supporting arms, and the other two were grafted on for operations.
The commander brigade, was that J.L. Moulton, the Marine general, who was commanding that brigade?
Quite right.
Yes. When you went off to your company command in Libya, thinking about it, was the company equipped and organised and run on the same sort of lines as it would have been in 1944-45?
Yes, absolutely. We were a motor battalion. We were equipped with international half tracks, which were getting very, very long in the tooth in those days indeed. They'd been going since, in the middle of the Second World War. And we had terrible problems of maintaining them and keeping them running and going. We were in this isolated little camp at Derna, much fought through and round, and during, of course, what we used to call the Benghazi stakes. And we were pretty well on our own. Most of the rest of the division was down in Tripolitania. But we did a great deal of training and exercising in the desert, and I took an expedition down to Kufra Oasis and all around that part.
Were you exercising for any particular style of warfare?
No, we were exercising on what was thought to be desert warfare. We harboured at night, and we protected tanks and things like that when we worked with them. But most of the tanks were up at El Agheila or down in Tripolitania, so we didn't see a great deal of them. But I think one of the reasons they didn't use the 1st Armoured Division was I think that the whole business of maintenance and spares was very, very limited. But, of course, there was an Anglo-Egyptian treaty which said that British troops who were stationed in Libya could not be used outside Libya without the permission of the Libyan government, which they would not have given.
Did you have anything to do with the local population in Libya?
Oh, yes, and, of course, they were very friendly. They were very friendly. The Senussi, the King Idris, was in charge. This was long before Gaddafi, of course. And on the whole, the people were very friendly. But once the Suez operation got underway, we had quite a bit of hostility. We had one officer stoned, either in Derna or in a village or something nearby. And we had bombs placed in our vehicles, small bombs, most of which, one went off, but most of which we were able to defuse because there was a warning with one going off and we looked and all the others and so on. But there was considerable hostility after the Suez operation from local people.
And was this based simply on a surge of nationalism coming across the frontier?
Yes, the Egyptians were very strong in Libya at that time. I mean, the threat then was not from Gaddafi and his own brand of leadership. The threat to the Senussi, and therefore indirectly to us, was from Egyptian-sponsored sort of intrigue and insurgency and Egyptian intelligence, trying to really stir up the people against King Idris.
Because it would seem to me that certainly the Senussi wouldn't have any particular sympathy with the likes of Colonel Nasser, who was radical and left-wing in his outlook, or at least in his ideological statements.
With whom?
The Senussi, yeah, would find themselves politically at odds with radicals
with
like
Nasser.
Colonel Nasser.
Oh, yes. Well, he would have done. He did do, and that is why the Egyptian intelligence were putting pressure on him. But of course the hostility to us didn't come from Senussi. It came from the Fellaheen, the local people, who the Egyptian agitators had obviously had some effect with.
Were there any Libyan armed forces to speak of?
Well, there was a thing called the Cyrenaican Defence Force, and there were various forms of armed police. They didn't come out positively against us, but they probably stood back and didn't do very much for me. I mean, it wasn't large, but I'd say we had one officer stoned in one incident. You were liable to get a sort of rock thrown at your truck if you went past, and, you know, there was general that sort of feeling. But this was in the immediate wake of Suez. We only stayed there because Benghazi was evacuated in the end of that year, and then we moved down to Tripoli. And I didn't. And there was a certain feeling down there, and that's when I left. In the end, very end of 50. Wait a minute. What are we talking about? 50. When was Suez? Can you remember exactly?
Autumn of 1956. So you were You mentioned you went back in September or October of 1956 to Tobruk.
No, that's right, yes. We did stay on in Bengal till the end of 57. And then at the end of 57, we went back, the whole battalion moved to Tripoli. And I then gave up my company in January 1958 and went to be a teacher at the Staff College.
Now, you were mentioning the original plans for landings at Alexandria. Now, these would have been presumably amphibious.
We're talking about the Suez operation.
The Suez operation, yes. When you were in the canal zone, and then later on when you were in MO4, you were getting ideas what was going to happen.
Yeah.
Did these original plans for
Musketeer
was the plan. Mm. Did these plans for landing in Alexandria in the Delta, did they involve the use of airborne assault as well?
Well, of course, the later operation did, absolutely true. That was, of course, a very crucial part. Parachute brigade landed and cleared the way for the commandos coming across the beach at Port Said. I'm sure it must have done, but I can't put my finger on exactly where it was, but I'm sure it must have done. But mind you, it was very early stages then. And I can't believe they wouldn't have used it in some way.
Presumably, though, you would have had to leave a fairly substantial force in the canal zone to look after the installations there if there were to be any move forward up towards...
Well, I mean, I think the theory... the theory was, of course, that a mixture of air attack, landing of Alexander, marching on Cairo, you would then remove the Nasser government and you would put in a government favourable to you and you would come to some other arrangements. I mean, I don't think it was intended to necessarily permanently reoccupy the canal zone. I don't think that was intended. I mean, we had taken the decision to move out. I think it was to re-establish satisfactory arrangements for the running of the canal. And, I mean, as you know, it all started by the Americans refusing to give a loan to the building of the Assouan High Dam, and then the nationalisation of the canal by Nasser, which we thought meant that the canal wouldn't be operated in a proper way. So there was nothing at that stage which said that we would leave a permanent presence. Could we just switch that off for 1 minute?
When you were involved in this planning process in the canal zone, when you were 3rd Division, did you have any contact with the Suez Canal Company?
Yes, I'm sure we... I didn't... I'm sure we did. The pilots, they call them pilots, or they were pilots, they took the ships down, were a mixture of British and French. And we met them at the various clubs and places, and I'm sure there was contact, yes.
Was there any official contact? Was the company, for example, consulted about the way in which military operations should be conducted to secure the canal and prevent sabotage?
It may have been, but it didn't come my way. I mean, it may be on the naval side they were consulted, I don't know.
And did you have any contact with the French or Israelis or any knowledge that they might be involved?
No. Well, mind you, this was 2 years before. There was no contact at that time.
Did you get any hints that this sort of thing was going on when you were working in the MO4 department back at the War Office?
No, because, of course, in those days, Palestine was still... When I was there in 1947, it was still a British mandate.
I'm thinking,
and we were trying to hand over power in a logical and coherent way.
I was thinking of the time.
Of course, eventually it was given up as a bad job.
I was thinking of the time when you were back in England when you were
on
MO4 staff with Nigel Powart.
Oh, no.
So there was
no inkling.
No inkling.
No, absolutely not. No, no, I mean, the thing was that we have got this international group headed by Bob Menzies was going to try and negotiate. And if they failed, we might have to take military action. But there was no talk of the Israelis when I was there at all. Didn't come anywhere near me. And, I mean, I still actually don't know, having read this book, because we can't get at the Chiefs of Staff minutes of that particular time, because anything to do with the Israelis has not been released under the 30-year rule. I still don't know who and when people were brought into this. I mean, Eden kept it very, very close to the chest indeed. And I suspect that the Chiefs of Staff were merely told at the 11th hour as a fait accompli.
Were you aware at the time of the ambivalent American attitude to the British policy towards Nasser and the prospect of a major operation to depose him?
Well, of course, they hadn't... they hadn't declared their hand as unequivocally and as ruthlessly as they did, of course, when the operation took place. When the Russians threatened nuclear action almost, and the Americans threatened the withdrawal of all World Bank loans and everything else. I mean, it was still a question. I mean, I think one of the mistakes that Eden made, in great contrast to Mrs. Thatcher at the time of the Falklands and to the coalition at the time of the Gulf, was that she hadn't massaged international and American opinion prior to taking this action. I mean, there obviously were negotiations, but there was no meeting of minds on this at all. I mean, the